This podcast is brought to you by Shout Engine. In less than 5 minutes, you can start your own podcast for free with ShoutEngine.com.
Live, yet another Hooniverse podcast coming from the Smoking Tire Studios here in Culver City. And this week, we do not have Jeff Glucker. We do not have Jason. We have Jonathan Klein in, one of our other rotating guest hosts.
And guest host? Come on. At this point, I've been on enough that it should be like Coco host.
Okay, so you're the Coco host.
I like that.
The Coco host.
The Coco host.
Okay.
Makes sense because I'm drinking something with cocoa and coffee and vanilla.
All right. I don't know what the hell that is. Anyway.
Porters.
Yeah.
Come up, people.
So, and of course, we've got the King of Silence himself. So,
hello. Oh, I've said too much.
Yes, Mr. Berdan.
Yes.
And then, of course, we have the man behind Scarbo. Otherwise known as beautiful suspension designs and hand-formed aluminum panels and things that if you're not aware of this company yet, you're going to be thinking about their stuff because it's kind of nutty.
Sex in car form.
Yeah. So where the hell are you in from? I know you're here in SoCal, but where'd you drive in from tonight?
Orange County.
Okay.
And I made a stop at the Peterson Museum on the way here.
It's looking good, isn't it?
It is. It's getting there.
Yeah. It's probably, I don't know, a few weeks away, right?
December 3rd it opens for the media.
Is it?
Cool.
I think I'm supposed to have an invite to that. I'm not certain, though.
Call up AJ.
Yeah, I will. Anyway, inside things, but yeah, it's looking good. All the new funky metal exterior is up. It finally kind of looks at home on Museum Row here in LA. So it was very kind of boring before, and now I mean it was originally a department store.
Really?
Yeah, it was back when like that was like a very Japanese part of the city. It was like a Japanese run department store where you could go and buy. So. Orange County. Whereabouts in Orange County, just out of curiosity?
So we were, my company for the last 2 years has operated out of the R. Sierra Racing Building.
Okay.
And the R. Sierra family is a family that I had the pleasure of meeting randomly. Should we get into that story or should I just talk through where
sure,
we're
sure, what the hell? Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a racing family. When you can attach the words racing and family after your last name, they've probably got a decent story.
And that's a fun family anyway.
Okay.
A bunch of Italians, you know, that throw stuff at each other and scream and whatever.
My kind of people?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You just keep meatballs in your back pocket, right, John?
That and
crescent
sausages.
Wrenches. Yeah. Crescent wrenches.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
those hurt a little more.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Mm-hmm. There you go. But go back a little further. I grew up racing go-karts as a kid. And from the age of 7, raced go-karts till I was about 14. Had a bad wreck. My mom told me I was done. So I would have to pursue my racing, you know, career not being a driver.
Well, you're about 5 inches too tall to go from being a kart driver to a professional race car driver.
Exactly.
You're not a wee man.
I would have, you know, I could have cut maybe 2-3 inches out of my calf.
Yeah.
You know.
Lowered yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do the opposite procedure that the little people do where they get the calf lengthening.
Yeah. I could give the bones to somebody that wants to.
You could do what I did and just crash a motorcycle and shrink down a quarter of an inch.
There you go.
Works perfectly. I now fit in cars. No, I don't.
So anyway, stopped racing go-karts, got into, as a kid, I was super into remote control cars and RC helicopters and sailplanes and whatnot. But at the end of my go-kart career, I got more into design and CAD modeling and whatnot, and then started going to Cal Poly Pomona. That was where I got my degree from. And one of my jobs when I went to Cal Poly is my second year, I moved back home to Orange County and I worked at Home Depot. And yes, Home Depot was a good deal. Worked there for 2 years. I don't think I've ever worked anywhere for more than a year and a half in my life.
You've got an engineering background. That's how we do things.
Which is odd. But anyway, long story short, working at Home Depot in tool rental. This guy comes in, renting a tool, and he says he's going to go in the store. And I said, well, you know, when you go in the store, I don't want you paying for your contract. What's your last name? I'll reset your contract when you leave. And he says, Arciero. I was like, Arciero? And I'd been around, obviously, go-kart racing and, mm-hmm. and kind of knew some names. And I said, like the wineries and the racing teams? He goes, yeah. So I said, what are you doing up here? He says, our race shop's right up the street. So at the time, I was building a four-seat long travel V8 rear-engine sand car in my buddy's garage.
Which
I had designed at the counter being a cashier prior to my
probably all the suspension geometry and everything, too, from scratch, right?
The funny thing is I talk to some friends about this all the time, and it's like the people that end up really doing neat stuff aren't the people that do great things right off the bat. I mean, you do it a crude way, and you push and push until you hit a wall, and then that changes your direction. But just the comical side of it is the suspension geometry for that was laid out with, you know, little zip ties that I'd made compasses out of and just doodling at the cash register, you know. Anyway, so I tell Al, I'm like, well, Al, you know, I'm in school right now getting my mechanical engineering degree, and I'm building an off-road car. And he told me to, you know, head up to the shop on Monday. So I went up there, talked to his fabricator.
Because he looked at you for 2 seconds. He went, cheap labor.
Exactly. And at the time, yes, Home Depot was fantastic. But I'm like, yes, just get me out of Home Depot. But went up there, met with him. And then Al was building. That was kind of the start of the luxury pre-runner time.
Somebody's really trying to get your attention.
I asked my buddy if he's coming to my wedding, and he's usually super flaky, but 3 calls in a row is just a little much.
A little excessive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to... Here, we'll shut the phone off here. That way he doesn't have a choice. Anyway.
So Arciero
went up and goes,
come by the shop.
Yeah. So he was building a luxury pre-runner. He hired me as a fabricator to help him out. So we finished that first pre-runner. And he took it to Mexico for the Baja 1000 that year.
And what time frame is this? What year is this?
This was somewhere around 2003.
Okay.
So like 12 mm-hmm. years ago. And anyway, we built the first car. He took it down to Mexico. Supposedly a lot of people were interested in buying it. He's like, I just built it. I don't want to sell it. But T-Force was an off-road team that was in Carlsbad Vista area. Mm-hmm. And they needed 2 pre-runners. So Albert and the Arcieros built 2 more pre-runners specifically for them.
And was it largely based on the same design, or
so
was it a whole new?
The first truck that was built was a hand fab truck that had Geyser Brothers suspension components on it.
Okay.
I don't know if you guys are familiar.
I'm not, but I'm assuming with the name being thrown out like that, it means something.
Well, Geyser Brothers build trophy trucks, and they're kind of like, I don't want to say, they're... If you want to buy a trophy truck, you want to get started, it's probably the least expensive to get into the trophy
truck. It's the Miata of the trophy trucks?
Sure. Okay. I like that.
Yeah. Those guys that own them are probably going to come and want to punch me in the face. But
my personal opinion on off-road racing is that the gentlemen that are racing the trucks are guys that are kind of playboys and want to have something that's loud and sounds neat. If they don't win, they're just going to go to the bar and get hammered.
So it's like the gentleman racers.
They're gentleman racers. And yeah, I think the reason it's been that way for so long is because there's very little media coverage in Mexico for the races. Because it's difficult. The races span such a large distance, and you can't really follow them well.
Logistically, it's hard. Exactly. Desert terrain sucks. I mean, it sucks to take cameras out there.
Exactly. So from a marketing perspective, big companies don't want to funnel dollars into sponsorship.
I mean, Lexus very famously yanked all their sponsorship when they had a winning team, you know.
Viper did too. Dodge did that with the Viper when they were racing Tudor.
Yeah.
They said, you know, you guys just won. 3 days later, gone.
Yeah. So aside from that, I worked on one of the few factory-backed off-road race programs. So after we built – so the first truck we did, Albert's truck, was a Geyser Brothers suspension components. Then for the 2 T-Force pre-runners, I designed the suspension components for those. So okay. Trailing arms, A-arms, front suspension geometry, all the suspension geometry.
Okay, so this is I gather, you know, I know a little bit about the off-road world. I am much more a track and canyon kind of guy, and I think that it's probably a fair assessment to say that a lot of our listeners are too. Not to say that there aren't people knowledgeable about this side of things, like Jonathan over here raising his hand emphatically. But when you go to design of a spoke off-road truck like this, how does it differentiate itself from like the kind of a suspension that you get on something like a Raptor, you know, where it is, it's based on a factory design, but it's a much more capable factory design, but obviously you're at a whole other level.
These trucks were based nothing on factory designs whatsoever. And it was literally, we'll loop back around. In fact, we do very little off-road. My company does very little off-road nowadays, and most of the stuff we do is road car
based. Yeah, I'm very familiar with one of your big clients. So,
a lot of the cars we built are just a cab or a sedan body draped over a tube chassis that was designed and developed from scratch.
Right.
And
the body at that point is purely ornamental.
100%.
It's a safety cage, right?
We're like 3/4 of the way through a CTS, Cadillac CTS project.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very high dollar project, and it's something that we're kind of having to do in waves with our customer. But that car is something where he came to us and said, this is what I want to do with the car, make it work. And it was something that at the get-go I was like, wow, this just sounds like a huge compromise, because he wanted to be able to road race this car, he wanted to be able to drag race the car, and he wanted to be able to do Texas mile events. So it's like, okay, are we setting up the suspension geometry to do what, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, you could get away with doing the mile and road race and similar setup, but the drag race is really...
The drag race is a whole different deal.
Yeah.
So we're going to get topic here real quick.
But back to the off-road stuff.
It happens.
Before we go down that road of bees, I really want to hear about that. But on the off-road side of things, what I was getting to is, we know how a regular truck works, that you get off the line or you're going to modify it, and a lot of people do. You know, they'll go and buy their Fox coilovers, and they'll go and do, you know, a body lift to get a little more tire clearance, put some big tires in there, do all that kind of stuff. When you're doing this bespoke setup, like, what kind of – you've got a trailing arm set up in the rear, right? Mm-hmm. You're obviously not doing max strut up front. But what kind of suspension design are you doing up front, and what are the goals there? Are you looking for maximum articulation? Are you looking for to get a lot of camber? What are you trying to get out of it?
The first comment is, when you're playing with factory pickup points, let's say you have a factory Raptor or Silverado or whatever,
right?
And you play with factory pickup points. As soon as you change the ride height, the roll centers change greatly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So really, if you're lifting it for aesthetics or if you're lifting it for ground clearance or something like that, fine. But when it comes to race vehicles, you really do, to get the performance that you need, you have to design it from scratch or be very clever about where you're moving pickup points to. With an off-road vehicle in particular, desert racing in particular, where they don't limit wheel travel, unlike Dakar and, you know, some other European forms of off-road racing.
Mexico's just go as fast as you can. I kind of like it. It's like a speedboat almost. It's just like you got to fill in the spot between the waves.
Exactly. And you want to try to keep the tire on the ground as much as possible, because if the tire's not on the ground, just like if the prop's not in the water, you're not propelling yourself
forward.
Well,
that's always the interesting thing with when you get into a truck that's got a lot of travel, whether it's, you know, it's spokes design like yours or somebody that's done a lot of work on a factory car, just the rebound damping on them is amazing. Mm-hmm. Because it's just, if it's really well done, you hardly even perceive the difference from bump to bump. It's just, you know, you go from that peaky up, down to what feels like a straight line, yeah. You know.
Well, I mean, you had BJ Baldwin's Recoil 3, where he jumped a 40-foot gap and came down like a ton of bricks, but it looked like, from the cab view, it looked like,
no big deal. Yeah.
I didn't feel anything.
Those trucks, after we did the two pre-runners at the RCROs, the RCROs got a contract from Volkswagen Motorsports to do a driver selection on-road program, which was the TDI Cup. And mm-hmm. then they also had the Baja Race Touareg TDI factory-backed SUV.
Yeah, TDI Cup was a pretty cool little series.
It was. And that lasted 3 years, and the off-road program was also supposed to last 3 years. I was the in-house engineer for that off-road program. Mm-hmm. And
for their Dakar stuff?
No, for the Baja Race Touareg.
Okay, so...
If you can... I don't know if you pull stuff up
online. Is that the one that, like, flipped, like, 16 times and, like, just completely disintegrated?
No, thank God. But that truck, to describe it a little bit, it was a designed from scratch. I had the pleasure of meeting a gentleman named Trevor Harris. He's an older race car engineer. Mm-hmm. He lives in Burbank. Him and I are great friends now. He's coming to my wedding. The Touareg chassis was based on a Herzog Trailblazer chassis. I don't know if you could, GM Vortec sponsored a team. And when we designed that truck, to give you an idea of just values, that truck had 25 inches of wheel travel in the front and 30 inches of wheel travel in the rear, which those are huge numbers.
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean, your average dirt bike has probably about 9. Your average downhill mountain bike has about 10 to 13, depending upon the setup. And those are two-wheeled bicycle-type things. And you're in a truck with 24 inches and 30 inches.
That's it.
That's insane. What would you say your average passenger car, what would you say to test travel-wise?
Average passenger car, like a road-going Sentra or something like that, probably has like 4 to 5 inches.
Yeah, that's
and an off-road. Insane. Pull up what a Raptor has. I would bet it's like
I would love
13,
to.
16 or something like that.
Our internet connection here is from 1994.
It's terrible.
We almost don't have the internet.
There's a lot
we'll put Jonathan on
on
this stuff. But
it works perfect.
The neat thing about that Touareg was it was mid-engine. X-Track built a sequential gearbox for it.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, unbelievable.
Works perfectly for podcasts that we can't see. But look it up. Look it seriously.
Yeah,
look
so it was the Baja Race Touareg TDI. If you type that into Google, you'll get tons of pictures. But
it's
was mid-engine.
Rake to the suspension. It's kind of cool.
It has the Audi R10 Le Mans V12 twin turbo diesel in it.
Wow.
And there's only like a handful of those motors, like maybe
now,
6.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. That doesn't pass the current emissions regulations, right?
So there was dialogue with Volkswagen in Germany at the beginning of that program to say, okay, what motor would, you know, do this program justice?
Yeah.
And at the time, the Q7 was available in Germany with a V12 twin turbo.
It's a great motor in that. That's a great motor.
That's not available here, though.
The
V10 TDI. The
V10 TDI
was available here in the Touareg.
Yeah.
But they didn't have the V12 available here. But long story short, they said those are not racing engines. Let's put a racing engine in it. So under the, you know, Audi group umbrella, VW group umbrella was that Audi V12. And it's funny because through that program, they wouldn't actually disclose to us what kind of torque that motor produced.
Yeah.
But,
you guys couldn't put it on a dyno?
When we went out testing, they had a kind of like a Formula One car. They had an engine mapping position.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, how much power do you want? And then crank it up, twist the drive shaft. Okay. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, how are you doing suspension and driveline design when you don't know the specifics of power output and things like power band?
So we did the general manager for that program, his name was Don Tebby, and a very clever guy, been around the off-road racing world forever. And he was one of those guys that, you know, he wouldn't listen to what somebody else had to say. He would have to prove it empirically with data or tests. So we had a 7-foot by 14-foot fixture plate in the shop, and we built a simulated rear end assembly with a third member. And we made this giant steel 15-foot long arm that we loaded with like 45-pound dumbbells to torque up the pinion. So we torqued up this Ford 9-inch rear end assembly. And I can't remember who was manufacturing at the time, but they're like, yeah, the two caps on the back of the bearings, you know, they don't move. It's a very rigid assembly. And we measured almost 1/8 of an inch of spread on those two caps when we torqued up the pinion, which is unbelievable.
And
which
this
means
like,
that your pinion alignment's gone. It's out the window. And we continue to lose third members. So
that's
That program was kind of, you know, we never got through the development really because it ended so quickly, but it was a neat program. The engineers from Audi in Germany were exceptional people.
It's interesting what you can get out of those guys when they don't have the constraints of dealing with road going cars.
Exactly.
Or hell, even the constraints they have with road going cars, and they just dial things back. That too.
It works. Yeah, here you go.
One of the funniest things that I think, and my dad told me that, my dad used to like slalom race in SECA, and he used to always tell me, don't make your street car your race car. because he said I did that and it was miserable. But
yeah, I can vouch for that.
Yeah, and it's the wrong move. It took me a while to learn that, to stop messing around with my streetcar. Now all the cars I drive around every day are completely bone stock.
I think you get that by the time you're about 27 or 28. You're like, I don't want to drive this every day anymore. That's right when you get old enough to be like, fuck this.
Exactly. And yeah. I went TESOL in college. I mean, yeah. I was trying to get to final exams and I was replacing the head gaskets in the car I was driving around at the time to try to get to final exams. And when you do that, that's miserable. And you're like, I'm done with this.
It's always interesting when you're like that age, when you're in college and you're doing major repairs in parking lots, like other people fill up their washer fluid and you're like, oh, I'm just dropping all the gaskets off the exhaust and fixing it in the parking lot before class.
Yeah.
Going deaf also is a bad thing too.
But
yeah. When you put too big of an exhaust and no muffler and no cats.
Yes. You and your FRS. But that aside, so heads, so race car, not your daily anymore.
No, definitely no. Okay. But what I was going to say is that after the Volkswagen program ended, I did some consulting for a company called Method Race Wheels. I don't know if you guys are...
Yes, I know the name, yeah.
So at kind of at the inception of that company, we did a lot of fun engineering work to get that company going, and some reverse engineering and a lot of stress analysis, and they came out with a fantastic product. And
Dirtfish uses them like exclusively.
Yep. So BJ Baldwin runs her wheels as well. Anyway, that's a whole different deal. But then after I kind of did a bunch of method stuff, I got a job working for a company called Kepler Motors, and they were developing a supercar from scratch.
Okay.
And
that name was bouncing around the blogs for a while there.
It if you dig deep into the mechanical side of that car, which I, you know, that was when I lost the majority of my social skills working for that company, because it was like buried in a cubicle with headphones on doing like crazy design stuff 8 to 10 hours a day. And that company is no longer, unfortunately. But that car has cast titanium suspension uprights on it that were made in Modena, Italy.
That's needed.
Okay. I'll show you these parts. Unbelievable. Okay. But
I don't know anybody that does cast titanium anything at this point.
Maybe Koenigsegg. Maybe. But they're using
3D printers, aren't they?
With everything.
Yeah.
3D printers and carbon.
Yeah.
3D printing is another.
Well, they're actually doing metal 3D printing.
No, correct. Yeah, DMLS.
Yeah.
Direct metal laser sintering. I don't know if this is, I can say this.
Figuring out what you can and can't say.
Yes, yes. There is a company that makes Formula One parts that are the parts that actually run on the Formula One car are 3D printed in Inconel and post machined, and they are run that way.
Okay.
Pretty incredible.
It's pretty rare that anybody makes Inconel parts. They're probably like the only people making printed Inconel parts.
Yes. You know, actually,
the titanium exhaust on the Koenigsegg? I thought those are.
Yeah, that's probably about it. I don't think there's much else.
I don't think anyone else does it. But, I mean, it's probably a safe bet. She's like, it's Koenigsegg. Koenigsegg does it. That works.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so speaking of Koenigsegg, while you're looking for stuff, they called out Porsche, Ferrari, and McLaren the other day. Well, they called out the world's press. Because everyone talks about the holy trinity of hypercars, and they're kind of pissed that they're not included in that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, a little bit of that I think was brewing from the Apex premiere that I was at last week. Because Christian was there, and then a gentleman was there from, let's see, we had, there was a guy there that was a driver for Pagani, and then a rep from McLaren, too. Which, as far as I'm concerned, amongst that top tier, those are the ones I care about. I love Porsche's products, and I like some of Ferrari's products. I hate Ferrari as a company. but to me...
Going to our next topic.
Yeah.
Your race cars.
Yeah.
Pagani is artwork. It's not the fastest, but it's not supposed to be. It's very fast, but it's not the fastest. It's just
gorgeous.
Gorgeous. Okay. And then Koenigsegg and McLaren are just the best. I mean... I don't think that there's...
You stare at it. You stare at the engineering behind it, and you're like, I am
not that smart.
You know, I was talking to a gentleman at the premiere that has had that owns all of those cars.
Because you do.
Yes, he is. He may come from some money in the Middle East. He was a very nice gentleman though. He goes, oh, none of them are as good as the McLaren. He's like, they're not even on the same level as the McLaren. He goes, no, that's the best. He goes, I don't even drive the other cars.
Why even have all that money?
So,
God damn it.
But anyway, you weren't fortunate enough to be born with oil money.
There's
only a handful of people that were.
Fortunate enough to be born with any money.
Back to your story. That part that you showed off, that's spectacular.
Yeah, and frankly, I hate to shout out my Instagram, but the Scarbo Performance Instagram, we have pictures on there of these cast titanium parts, which are gorgeous parts.
No, by all means, promote your. We want them to go look at this stuff. That's why you're here.
Yeah, perfect.
I stare at it as much as possible.
But there's you can kind of see some of the stuff we've developed as well. Back to the OE side of things. Yeah. When I worked for Kepler Motors, the CEO of that company was tied in with Ford Well. So we got a lot of before the EcoBoost had really, you know.
That was back when it was still a Mazda motor.
To be honest, I don't know.
I'll
premise something else. I am not a drivetrain guy for the most part. Not like an engine guy, I won't tell you.
Fair enough.
Engine tuning. You know, I'm not that guy. I'm a chassis suspension guy for sure. But when we worked with Ford, some of the technical documentation that we received on the EcoBoost development was so in-depth that it opened my eyes to what OEMs actually do. When they develop and produce a car, there's so much engineering and research that goes into every facet of that car that as soon as you toy with it, play with it, you're compromising something. And a lot of times, for all of us that like to tinker with our cars, you're compromising it in the way that you like, whether, you know, you're changing the shocks, changing the springs, wheels and tire packages, brake packages. Obviously, the components we choose to put on are more costly
than the OE parts. Our compromises are obviously, the priorities are much different than theirs, in that we may want to go put coilovers on something, whereas the average person that goes and buys it is going to go, that ride's rough.
Exactly. And that's the unfortunate side of working for an OEM is you get to, you're filling the needs of the 99% of customers that are just going to go drive their car to and from work.
It's like making a sitcom for NBC in the 1990s. It had to appeal to everybody because that was what they sold.
Yep. And a testament to that, something that, you know, you go through life, you find all these different scenarios that are like, oh, that's why that's that way. But CV joint technology, for example, anybody that's taken apart a six-ball CV joint.
Oh, it's just, we've come leaps and bounds.
The funny thing about that is that for OE applications, the ball and the ball track that the ball rides within is relatively tight tolerance. And the reason they do that is mostly for noise, vibration, and harshness. If you loosened up that ball track tolerance, you would hear it. You'd hear it clack and make all kinds of noise. But in racing applications, if you order steel balls that are undersized to where the ball physically has more clearance within that track, it gets more oil and generates way less heat. And that's something that I don't think anybody would ever, you know or stumble upon. I had the pleasure of meeting with the ex-chief of R&D for Dana Spicer. We were doing some drivetrain development stuff. Another thing on my Instagram, we have a 70-degree constant velocity joint that we have been developing for Trevor Harris.
That's a lot of angle.
Yeah, this thing's unreal. But I'm going to try not to do this anymore.
But yeah, I mean,
it takes me off topic.
Obviously, the things that Ford and GM and Volkswagen.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous. That shouldn't bend the way it does.
Yeah, it's wild. And the funny thing about Trevor, I think Trevor's 78 or 79 now, and he's been, I mean, the Nissan GTP cars in the 90s were his design work.
Okay.
As well as, I mean, a number of other race car programs. But he has always had to design with a pencil and paper, and he usually designs full scale if he can on these giant drafting boards. And the beauty of that is that he's had to learn how to design in 3D in his head versus everybody nowadays. We all design in CAD and then we lay something out and say, oh, this doesn't work. He's like 10 steps ahead of me watching me model in CAD like, oh, that's not going to work. This isn't going to work, you know. So he conceived the geometry of that joint basically in his head. And then we kind of executed it in CAD and did some development and stress analysis, dynamic rotating balance, whatever. But it is a neat joint. So we filed a... our international PCT patent for that about a month ago.
And, yeah, it's just maybe slightly less bendy than a Slinky.
Yeah, it's unreal. It's crazy. And it plunges. And it has no boot.
Oh, it doesn't need a boot either.
Yeah,
I guess it wouldn't.
So, I mean, think of all these off-road cars that have, you know, you're limited, like especially Class 1 buggies, for example. Independent rear suspension, you're limited at somewhere around 25 degrees of CV joint angle. Yeah. But and you have to worry about these boots, and guys put leather boots over the boots. They're like double booted. So we need to get this thing developed, get some good prototypes. We're working on a retrofit for my off-road car that I built when I was working at Home Depot, oddly enough. And
overkill much?
Well, the funny thing, well, my off-road car is kind of funny. It has transverse leaf springs. My buddy,
okay,
we were drinking one. I have this buddy. He's one of those guys that he's brilliant, and he just says a lot of things. He never shuts up, frankly, and he drinks quite heavily. And but a lot of the stuff he says, if you glean and you execute, it's good stuff. But he would never execute it just because he's just
all over the place.
So anyway, one night he's like, yeah, you should do a buggy with transverse leaf springs. And I kind of thought about it. And
well, that makes sense. You can lighten up on the sway bars. You can.
Well, yeah, so
yeah.
My sand car has no sway bars. It has no coils, no coil springs. And it's four-wheel independent. And it has these ridiculous leaf springs that Deaver built for me.
But if you listen to Jeremy Clarkson, transverse leaf springs only belong on buggies.
Well, all Corvettes have transverse leaf springs.
I know, I own one.
Which is the funny thing, you know? People think you're crazy until it's
no,
like,
people
oh,
think
that's
they're
been on cars
people
since
think
the
they're
1960s.
Crap,
yeah.
But there's a reason that they use them, is they've got an incredibly long life. I mean, a good set of fiberglass springs are going to last a long, long time. They don't corrode.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you don't have to go as crazy on the sway bars because you've got that rigidity and you've got the crosstalk with them with the leaf springs. I mean, that's the upside to them.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying the Corvette implementation is perfect, but there's a reason people do them, you know, and quite clearly, you know, you're building some crazy shit and you've decided to do transverse leaf springs. So I want to see that when it's done.
Granted, this was while I was in school and I was designing stuff with zip ties on backsides of paper at the cashier register. But anyway, come a long way since then.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of suspension research when I worked for Kepler, and that was all push rod stuff, all, you know, cantilever rocker type suspension systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that had adjustable ride height and, you know, all kinds of weird stuff. But through that, I learned a lot. And since then, we, for some reason, a lot of people come to us with push rod suspension system needs. And BBI Autosport has a rocker kit for the 996, 997.
Yep. We just released the Batim episode we did last week.
Awesome.
So
cool.
Very cool. Anyway, so that's kind of like a jewelry thing. People think it's cool, but there are technical advantages as well.
Well, I mean, could you speak to them? Because, I mean, I'm a bit of a suspension geek, so we could talk into the specifics. But, I mean, I don't know that a lot of people understand readily why you would do a cantilever design versus a more traditional, you know, direct drive kind of driving the damper itself.
Sure. When you operate a damper or shock over a pivot, like a rocker, You provide yourself the ability to change the ratio with which the wheel activates the damper. So if you have the spring and shock directly coupled with the wheel, if you move the wheel up 1 inch, the shock is going to move 1 inch. Whereas if you have a rocker assembly, you can make it progressive. And that BBI kit, for example, has 5 pushrod positions to where you can make it linear or very progressive or anywhere in between. So basically what that means is, let's say you come around a corner or come over a rise and the car unloads. As the car regains traction with the road, the rate at which the wheels compress is very soft, so it regains traction graciously. And then as it gets into a high load scenario, your spring rate goes way up when you need the high spring rate. And at the end of the day, what you're really trying to do is you're trying to make the contact patch have as few peaks and valleys. You're trying to even out the contact patch pressure. So if you can do that with a progressive rate to where, you know, it's not super abrupt when it initially makes contact. And then obviously if it wasn't progressive, you end up blowing through the shock and the spring, and then you run into a bump stop. And a bump stop is this, you know, huge spike in tire contact pressure. So at the end of the day, if you can have a progressive rate shock, you end up with something that can deal with all the different driving scenarios and evens out kind of the...
And you get the side benefit, too, of pulling a lot of unsprung weight off if you're if you have that shock hanging off of, like, your A-arms or something.
That is true as well.
That's what you get.
Yes. That, it's a gain for sure. But in regard to OE, like, streetcars and adding these systems to streetcars, it's marginal. That's a marginal gain.
Yeah. Well, packaging becomes a real difficulty at that point.
And it becomes one of those things. When you're really looking to push the envelope, you have to design, develop everything from scratch. Because... Yeah. Something gets compromised.
I can't remember if you told me this or not. Did you work with Chenu at Sector 111 for the Dragon Spider?
Cause I did not.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But I do
he runs Chenu, that yeah. same type of system for the Spider.
Correct.
Okay, uh-huh. So Progressive Springs.
Yeah, I think you're seeing but a lot more.
The other side to it is just because you put a rocker assembly doesn't mean it's geometrically going to be correct. Because you could have it
work. You're a little far from the mic, actually. At this
Sorry
point.
About that.
No problem.
What I was saying is that just because it has a rocker doesn't necessarily mean that the geometry is correct.
It means it's going to look cool.
It's going to look cool.
Yeah.
Right off the bat. But depending on how the rocker actuates the shock, those angles are very important.
And then you get some funky setups too, like the Koenigsegg rear suspension design, their triplex design, where they've got a cantilevered system. But then they've actually got like another damper that actually connects the two so that they – I think they avoid getting – I think they basically get out of the situation of needing a rear sway bar by the way they've designed it.
I so wish I was Alex Kelsey right now. This is so over my head.
Oh.
I saw a car. I was at Thermal over the weekend racing our vintage Formula car deal. And there was a Radical. There was a Radical that was there in the shop. And mm-hmm. I was just kind of looking over the suspension. And I have for the first time, I'd never seen a sway bar system like this. But it's basically a bent rod that runs between the two rockers that basically just moves laterally when the two wheels move up and down at the same rate.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's forced to bend as soon as there's a differential in wheel movement.
Ah.
I've never seen anything like it. Very clever.
Yeah.
Super cost effective.
See, I think Koenigsegg does it largely with kind of... they're basically pulling on a damper body so that it's basically trying to draw the fluid through. So it's got some resistance on it. So it can move independently, but it's actually drawing resistance on it. It's been a while since I've heard his explanation on it. But same sort of idea, different implementation of a similar thought, though.
It looks like a cantilever suspension with, like what you said, like a sway bar in the middle that connects the two, but it has a spring in the center.
The way that works is correct. Let me see the picture again. Which car is this again?
Koenigsegg. I think that's the Agera. There are better pictures.
Oh, I got research to do when I get home.
Yeah, yeah. It's too bad that, he was here last week. Would have been nice if put you two in a room for an hour and go like, what do you got?
Seriously.
Here's a better picture.
Those technical conversations get a little out of hand most of the time.
Well, yeah.
With Christian, yes.
Yeah. Well, that night we also had our buddy Dan that runs Forza as well, this creative director over there. So you want to talk suspension, I'll put you in a room with Dan too, because they're sitting there modeling it after, they've got to reverse engineer everything the OEs are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So Dan's gotten to know. He's like, yeah, we're doing modeling on moment of inertia that literally nobody does right now. So
we're working on building kind of a stand to basically what it'll do is it'll take a car and you put the car at a given angle.
Yeah.
And when you put the car at the angle, it kind of tells you where the CG is at, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then once you do that, then you start designing all your roll centers based around where the actual CG is. So reverse engineering is a big part of what we do as well. We had a customer of ours has like a 944 race car build.
Oh, yeah. Those are always easy to work on.
It has an LS3 in it.
Well, he fixed the biggest problem in the car.
Yeah. So it's an LS3 944, and it has like GT3 front and rear subframes. But the placement of the subframes, the roll center is kind of,
Yeah, that is a Frankenstein of a car.
Yes, it is. It is. But we put it up on the lift.
A lot of fun.
We geek engineers like this, but we bought a ferro arm about a year ago.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody's familiar with what that is.
No,
but it's like this. It's basically a 6-foot long arm that anything that you contact with this arm goes into CAD.
I know exactly what you're saying.
And it is the most insanely accurate thing. I mean, it's a 6-foot arm, so it can reach like a 12-foot sphere.
Well, yeah, it's always aware of where it is in space because it's stationary and it moves around and touches everything.
100% correct. Yeah. And it is, I think its advertised accuracy is plus or minus 2/1000ths in that 12-foot sphere.
I think maybe the best way to explain it to somebody that wouldn't have it is when you've seen things where they put the little stickers, the little dots all over it, and they try to laser scan it.
Yes.
Imagine that without having used stickers and a stupid laser scanner.
Yeah, with using like a, you know, whatever. Let's say you had a pencil, you could go around and touch anything, digitize, whatever. But to give, you know, people listening an idea of 2/1000ths, a human hair is somewhere around
human hair
2 to 4
micron. So I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it depends on whose hair it is. Yeah. But I digress. Anyway, the actual accuracy that I've found with that thing is far less than 1/1000ths of an inch. They advertise 2/1000ths, and it'll tell me if something is flat or round within 5/10,000ths. So, anyway, long story short, we get this 944, and we put it on the lift. And the funny thing is, if you touch this probe to like a spherical bearing or a rod end, people right. know what heim joints are, right? If you can see part of the ball in the rod end, you touch the probe to the outside of that sphere, pick up like 10 or 12 points off of it, mm-hmm. and it dumps that sphere in space. So literally, you just go around, you touch the spheres of all the rod ends, and then you pull that data into CAD, and now you have all of the suspension geometry.
You have every single pickup.
And then you tell them, if you want to get the bump steer perfect, you got to move this 3/4 of an inch this way, this half inch up, this. It's cheating, really.
So it's like the world's greatest alignment tool.
It is, yeah. And it's an alignment tool that actually pulls all the pickup points.
Yeah.
So so that's been fun. And
I want to play with it.
It is. Yeah, you're more than welcome. Come by the shop whenever you like. And
here's me fabricating like brake brackets in my garage and being like, well, this is as good as I'm going to get here.
That's another thing we use it for. We did a brake duct for the new M4. Bullet Motorsports is one of our customers, and they had an M4 come in. We brought the ferro arm over. We digitized all the pickup points of where the existing brake shield would go. Mm-hmm. And then we designed a 3D printed, actually was the mock-up, a 3D printed brake duct that has a 3-inch inlet.
Isn't that fantastic that we can...
It's
so easy. It makes prototyping so much faster.
It's cheating.
Yeah.
It really is cheating. And
I'm actually trying to get my first 3D printer for the house so that I can do my own intake design.
Mm-hmm. Which one are you going to get?
Well... I was initially looking at the MakerBots just because I had somebody go, well, might be able to hook you up with a little bit of a discount. But there was a couple of the lesser known ones that I was looking at that are – it's got a bigger table to it. So I want something that I'm going to be able to do at least like 12 by 12 on.
Okay. Cool. Gotcha.
I just got back from Montana and was out there to pick up a car with a friend of mine. He has a shop that does like 3D printed switches for like adding auxiliary and stuff to like RX-7s or kinds of stuff. And it's like – so just that level of rapid prototyping. It's like I was there and they did like 6 different like changes and making things work differently.
Well, I mean, it would have been before we would have either had to CNC it.
Yeah.
Or we would have had to send it out somewhere to get made. I mean, we'd send them the files and be like, make it. And we'd come back, 6 or 8 weeks later and we'd have a prototype. And now, I mean, I started my career in aerospace and it would take forever to get anything done. And that was...
Now it's a couple hours.
Jesus Christ, I'm getting old. That was 16 years ago, and, you know, and it was to think this is where we've gotten now. And you know, 3D printers were kind of sort of starting to get to be a thing then, but Lockheed had them and Boeing had them, not, you know, a shop of your size or me in my living room,
yeah.
You know.
And you can do things like all sorts of organic design.
Anything. That's great. 3D printing has its place. It is amazing,
yeah.
No doubt. But you get the most value in 3D printing with complex, small geometries.
Yeah.
Because the machine does not care what the geometry is. Like you said, it'll print organic surfaces. It'll print mechanical features. The tolerance varies depending on what process you're using.
Okay.
But 3D printing gets really neat when it assists other technologies. So, for example, those cast titanium suspension uprights that I was telling you guys about, those were investment cast with a 3D printed master. So it basically burns out the 3D printed part.
Yep.
There's a few different ways to do that and a few different materials too. So there's like a wax 3D printer. Well, they're 3D print a wax part, coat it in ceramic, melt the wax out, and then investment cast in whatever material you want.
Yep.
Another process that I used quite a bit a few years ago was there's some high-resolution resin 3D printers that print in 16 or 32 micron layers, which is...
tiny.
Yeah, like somewhere around a thousandth of an inch or something like that. And what you can do is you can 3D print a mold, and then you can assemble that mold after it comes off the 3D printer and then inject it with a urethane, for example.
So let's say, because that's ABS, and the urethane will peel right off of it.
So you have to use a mold release or whatever. But I worked for a company that did sensor wearables, and one of the applications was golf. And we had a meeting on Monday morning, and we kind of decided we were going to develop this little product, whatever. And by the end of Monday, I had the part design. By Tuesday morning, I had the mold for the part designed. By Wednesday morning, I had the mold in-house. And by Thursday morning, I had a part demolded, ready to rock. It's like that product development process is unbelievably fast. I mean, the fact that you can have a meeting on a Monday and put a product in, you know, in the boardroom in someone's hands that same week is unreal.
Well, and some of the stuff that I was looking at is just like now you can actually get you can actually get 3D printers that will do that will actually inject carbon fibers into it too. I mean, obviously not big strands, but small carbon fibers to where it's rigid enough that you can start doing, you know, non-critical structure out of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the fact that we're, you know, interior bits or mounting points or just little shit like that. The fact that we can do that now, and of course, you know, give it 10 years from now and the, the metal, I mean, whatever you called it before, I can't remember what the actual term is for it, but the, you know, basically when you take a powdered metal and then you throw a laser at it and you go, here's a solid thing now.
And it's fully dense.
Yeah.
And it's material property wise better than cast. Yeah. It's not a forged part, but obviously very usable material properties.
Yeah,
That CV joint linkage type thing that you guys saw, that was all those arms are 3D printed in nylon. Mm-hmm. That has real hardened ground shafts and bearings in it. But right now we're working with a vendor that's going to 3D print all of those parts in 17-4 stainless, which and that's what we're actually going to run in the car is 3D printed CV joint parts. So
that's pretty spectacular.
So it's either going to be really awesome or really awesome when it blows up. But there'll be a lot of GoPros watching it it happens.
Yeah.
So.
But that's part of R&D.
Exactly.
Okay, so...
17 GoPros.
Right around you know, the joint. Clearly, you've spent a lot of time in the world of suspension design. However, when I was first introduced to you at SEMA, I was told, yeah, this guy's making reproduction Ferraris with hand-beaten aluminum panels. And I'm like... What? Who in the fuck does that? Who does that, and why are you doing it? And
I walked in, I just saw pictures, and I started drooling.
It was Richard from Magnaflow. He's like, yeah, I'm building these 8-into-1 exhaust collectors for these guys. And I'm like, who does this?
So the story of that car is that obviously we do a lot of one-off engineering for people's dream projects. I mean, people come to us that have said, hey, I've really wanted to build this, this, or that. And we do tons of engineering, and we build their car. And at the end of it, it's like, okay, what's the next project? And for the business, I really wanted to build something that we could do as a semi-production something just to kind of keep the shop going and keep everybody busy. But when I decided what to build, I was looking for a car that really lent itself to our capabilities. Obviously, we have a fab shop. We do engineering. We do machining. And I was thinking, okay, well, you know, what kind of car could we build? Something that's obviously not some crazy composite body. We don't really do composites. But a car I've been obsessed with since I was a kid. I had a poster of it on my wall. It's a 67 Ferrari 312 Formula One car. And... I do genuinely think that it is the most beautiful Formula One car that has ever existed. A good buddy of mine, there's a Shell commercial that I don't know if you guys have seen, but it's a Ferrari Shell commercial, and they run through Formula One through the years. So it shows this like 1950s Formula One car coming down the road, and all of a sudden it turns a corner, and it's a 67 Ferrari 312, the car that we kind of did a tribute build to. Anyway, long story short, I love the car, and I was looking to recreate it in a way that people could really enjoy and experience it as a track day car. Something that, you know, somebody could buy for relatively low cost, obviously not even close to what the original would cost, but they could work on themselves. So when we talked to some people about, you know, what power plant should it have, and everybody kind of said, if you're recreating a vintage Ferrari, it has to have a Ferrari motor in it. And I struggled with that at the beginning a lot.
Dumb idea.
Which, you're doing a recreation and going to put a vintage Ferrari motor in it. The vintage Ferrari motor would probably cost five times what the rest of the job had at that point.
It would also cost five times to rebuild every other.
Exactly. Yeah. So it becomes a maintenance problem. It becomes a reliability problem. Not saying that Ferraris aren't reliable or anything. But we ended up choosing four. So we sell the car in six different variations. Three variations as rolling chassis. Three variations as turnkey cars. The turnkey cars we only produce with GM LS crate motors. If you want to purchase a rolling chassis, you can put a Ferrari motor in it. People have talked about putting a BMW V10 M5 motor in it.
Which would be great because that motor makes a great noise.
With a 10-into-1 collector, I'm sure it would sound...
I'm sure Richard would love to make them a custom exhaust for, you know, 50 grand.
Side note, Richard's fantastic. He was really great working with us. But
Zach and Thad...
Wait. Yeah. Will it fit?
The way that we have the chassis fixtures set up is we could technically, on our fixture plate, extend the wheelbase 6 inches. Easy. It's just literally you move the rear fixture rearward, you extend the length of the tubes that connect it to the main chassis, and boom, you fit a M5 V10 in there. Yeah.
I don't think the M5 V10 is that much longer than the V8. It's probably just the width more than anything, right?
But what I tell
it
people...
It fit one in a Lotus. Yeah. It fit one in an Elise. Like, someone did it, I think, a couple months ago. I saw it online.
That sounds amazing.
It looked amazing, and just from the driving video, it just was screaming.
My suggestion for anybody that wants to put something different in it, because once again, everything we do is designed 100% in CAD and figured out. And as soon as you say, okay, well, I want to put a different motor in it, well, that's a lot more work to really iron out all the details. It, yeah. So what I suggest is there was a gentleman in Florida purchased a car. And he bought it as a rolling chassis, and he built a Ferrari 308 V8 to put in it. But he wants to vintage race it. So if he's vintage racing, getting them to allow it into a class, if he's saying it's a Ferrari and it actually has a Ferrari motor, then that's a whole lot easier of a deal. And I think he was looking for an authentic F1 or F2 car from 1967 Ferrari, and he was just struggling with finding one that he wanted to race, so that was his justification.
Well, yeah, even then, even if you could, it's really, would you responsibly race a vintage Ferrari race car, you know?
That's the second point, is that if you owned the authentic Ferrari Formula One car from 1967,
would you
actually push it? I mean, not only would it be a huge financial deal if you crashed it, but it'd be like a travesty to vintage motorsport or something like that. Not that it couldn't be rebuilt and recreated, but it's like you're crashing a piece of
history. Well, if you've got the money to pick it up, the financial concern's probably not really there. If you've got the money to buy the car in the first place, you're like, whatever, I don't care if I crash it. But it's more the point of crashing a one-of-a-kind car that maybe, you know, one or two exist in the world.
Yeah. So the car we build, it's gorgeous.
So rolling chassis, what is a rolling chassis run with you guys?
Okay, so pricing that we currently have for these rolling chassis start at $79,000.
Which is was the really surprising thing. When you told me that at SEMA, I was like, you're fucking kidding me.
And we've obviously tried hard to bring – we want to get the price point down because we want people to enjoy this car. But at the end of the day, we've put a lot into it. The wheels for the car are made just for – we designed them. They're made in Spain. Mm-hmm. They're forged wheels. A set of tires are – they're Avon Historic Slicks. And at the end of the day, getting these parts, I mean, it just – it adds up. I mean, anybody that's built a car, even if you think you want to build a car, you put a spreadsheet together that kind of says itemizes your costs. And if you've done it before, you think, okay, I should probably double this number. Because that's what it's actually going to cost me.
Well, that's any car project. You always double the number.
And it's funny. I just had a conversation with a friend about this the other day, that when you start a car project, you get 80% of the way through. You've spent that initial amount that you thought was going to take you to the end. And you're like, well, I've only got 20% left to go. But in that last 20%, it takes you the same amount of time and the same amount of money to mm-hmm. figure out all the details, you know. So
it's almost finishing touches.
Exactly. But
and then I assume you're rolling, you know, your turnkey cars probably vary wildly depending upon what the customer's asking for.
They do, for sure. Yeah. So the full tilt, aluminum bodied, 4130 chassis, heat treated suspension components, forged wheels. It has 6-piston calipers on all four corners. Vented brakes is around 175 grand.
And what does that car weigh?
1,280 pounds.
With an LS7 in it.
It is. I raced the car this weekend for the first time.
Yeah.
And we were doing towards the end of the weekend, we were doing 2-minute, 10-second laps at thermal. And there were only a few cars from the vintage car side. It depends on what you call a vintage car. There was a Porsche, the Jägermeister Porsche 962 was there. Mm-hmm. Tom Hacker was driving it. And he was doing, I think one of the days he did a 2-minute, 8-second lap. But he was doing 2-minute 10s, 2-minute 11s. So we were doing basically the very similar lap times with something with no aerodynamics.
And your car, that's not a power to weight ratio. That is an exercise in trying not to light up the wheels every single time you hit the gas. It 1,200 so pounds.
We did something else kind of funny with this car, and it played out well. So we did our so it's an LS motor. That's the car I raced over the weekend was our first prototype, first one we ever built.
Yeah,
okay. It has a 2001 Corvette LS1 in it, bone stock.
Still 350 horsepower.
You know your numbers for sure.
Yeah,
but it has Hillborn injection, and it has the 8:1.
So you're probably more around 410, 420 horsepower.
So it made 385 horse at the wheels.
Yeah, I know my engine. Yeah.
So it made 385 horse at the wheels, and we did our own throttle by wire system for it. So it uses a BMW M5 throttle body motor.
Yeah, because those originally were just mechanical throttle on those cars,
and Hillborn, for the most part, they do all mechanical throttle linkage.
Yeah, I was going to say that's kind of a weird combo. I've never heard of them working on that.
They didn't, so we developed it
okay.
from scratch. Brett at Bullet Motorsports did the ECU tuning. And basically what we did with it is because we had throttle by wire, he could map the throttle to do whatever we wanted. So I told him, wanted to see 280 foot-pounds of torque or whatever it made at max RPM,
yep.
I wanted that to run from 2,000 RPM all the way to redline. So when you come out of a corner and you get into the throttle at 4,000 RPM or 3,500 or something like that, it's not actually giving you
wide. So rather than charting timing, you're doing torque management via throttle control.
Correct.
So you're doing it kind of like the later LS motors do it at their ECU. What are you using for an ECU? Are you using like a Metega Sport system?
It's a VIPEC.
It's a VIPEC. Okay. VIPEC, yeah. I'm not familiar with them specifically, but...
It was... once again, back to what I said earlier, I'm not an engine guy.
Yeah.
Not a tuning guy. So when... Brett's a very knowledgeable guy, and when him and I started talking about the program, I said, Brett, you're going to be the one that's completely responsible for executing the entirety of this. You pick whatever ECU you're comfortable with. So he said, I have experience with the VIPEC. They do traction control, and let's go for that. So the car uses a VIPEC ECU, and then we have a RacePack PDM and a RacePack display.
Makes sense. Why reinvent the wheel? They make good stuff.
And they're down the street. I can walk there from my house.
Yeah.
So
that helps.
Yeah. And they worked with us on the Volkswagen Baja Race Touareg program.
And the great thing is you can just use their GPS sensor for what your speed is. You don't have to deal with picking up.
I'm so mad because I have a G2X Pro data logger, RaceBack data logger,
mm-hmm.
that I didn't have in the car over the weekend. And I was dying to get top speed at the end of that main straight on the South Palm Circuit. And I was just dying to get top speed. So I got an app for my phone, which I taped to the dash of the car. And then I was like, I got the app running. I'm like, cool, app's running. Put my gloves on, and I saw some little green button that was on my phone. I was thinking, I wonder what that says. Like, is it recording or it needs me to touch it? So I tried to tap it with my hand, but with your gloves on,
yeah.
You can't do it. I'm not going to pull my gloves off, like, racing around this track. That car's a handful. I mean, it's fun, but it's a handful.
Why do I get the feeling that one of your fingers is not going to be covered in that glove sometime in the future?
I could do that. Yeah. You know, I hadn't thought about that. I could just cut one of the fingers off. But anyway, long story short, I didn't set what the start finish line was on the app.
So you got to do a lap beforehand.
Yeah, so I didn't get a top speed. But needless to say, that car has the first prototype we built has an LS motor.
Yeah.
And it has a Porsche Boxster 5-speed, which comes in a standard Boxster, early standard Boxsters.
Yeah.
And those transmissions are notoriously weak. Which
everything in an original Boxster is notoriously weak.
So when I was talking to a lot of my clients are Porsche clients, and I don't know how it happened, but it just happened. But
he started doing business with BBI. That's how that happens.
But Vision Porsche is another company, and I was doing business with them in like 2010, which was like a couple years before BBI. I don't know how that happened, but anyway. And everybody I talked to, they're like, "Wow, they're like, what motor are you coupling that with?" I'm like, "LS." And they would just laugh like, that's not going to live. But I think my saving grace has been that we clipped peak torque at low RPM. Yep. The car only weighs 1,280 pounds, which
it's
means
not very stressed.
You can only put so much power down.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't weigh enough to put the power down in low gear. So that really limits how much torque you can put through the gearbox. And
and that's the thing that's how you always break stuff when you're drag racing is when you dead hook. And you've got lots and lots of torque. You dump a clutch at 5,000 RPM. You dead hook. That's when you shatter everything.
Oh, yeah. Low gear.
But.
Done deal.
Yeah.
As you go up through the gears, all that happens to the rest of the drivetrain after the ring and pinion is torque goes down and down and down and down.
So if you can survive first gear.
Which, yeah, at thermal, we never get into second gear. It's a third, fourth, fifth track.
Yeah, you've probably got really long gearing on that too, right?
It has factory gearing, but the rear tires are Avon historic slicks that are monsters. Mm-hmm. The car has 14-inch wide wheels on the back.
As it would need them.
Yes. And they're 27 inches tall. So I think the factory Boxster tire is somewhere around 25 inches and it has factory gearing. So we were probably spinning. This is why I wanted to know top speed. 27-inch tire, probably a little bit of growth at speed. And 5,500 RPM in fifth gear at the end of the back straight. That's got
to
be moving.
And you've got another 1,000 RPM to go.
Yeah. So
that's moving.
Right?
That's really moving.
So but the car's fun. We actually lost a CV joint in practice Friday morning, so we didn't get to race on Sunday, which was unfortunate.
Are you using when you get down to those kind of components in that car, are you trying to use stuff that's readily available?
Everything that I could, I tried to use off-the-shelf parts.
Okay, good.
So just to keep the cost of the car down. Because, once again, when you build a race car, you can go to the moon with every component. I could have SKF, center lock hub. I'm not saying that I would. But race components, as everybody knows, are very expensive. So that's another funny story, is that when we were doing the ECU tuning, Brett was having trouble getting the engine to fire, and it would run on four cylinders. And then he would change the cam trigger and it would run on the other four cylinders. And he couldn't get a good cam trace.
Okay.
So we're like, geez, like what's going on? And it was a Sunday when he's doing this. So he's like, maybe the sensor's bad. And it was a brand new sensor we ordered. Maybe the sensor's bad. So I was like, okay. So I went to Pep Boys. I was like, yeah, do you guys have a cam sensor for like a 2001 Camaro? Like, oh yeah, we have in stock. Boom. Put it in, fired.
Yeah.
And then we lost a starter later that day because we had been cranking the thing all day trying to get it to run. So I went back to Pep Boys and I said, hey, do you guys have a starter? Oh yeah, we have a starter. And it's that to me was the testament to use OE components where
you can.
Well,
that's the funny thing is that you can go get a starter for any truck or any Corvette, any Camaro made since
it will fit.
1997.
Exactly. So That was neat, but at the end of the day, the car is crazy, crazy fast. It's predictable. It doesn't have aero, so you're not varying how fast you can enter a quarter based on vehicle speed.
It's all mechanical
grip. It's all mechanical grip, and it sounds ridiculous.
Well, yeah, tell me about the exhaust, because Richard was telling me that he's building an 8-into-1 for that. Is it a 180-degree header into a 1 and into an 8?
It's, so my personal opinion, it's the easiest way to get the timing of the exhaust pulses equispaced to generate a high frequency. Mm-hmm. So what we did is I actually have an intern that designed the headers, and port to collector, all 8 primaries cord length is within a 16th of an inch.
Okay.
And really the only way to do that is with CAD. because a lot of header guys, and you can talk to great header guys, and if they're honest, they know there's a tolerance in what they're building. They're not making exact equal.
Well, they only
headers.
Have to be as good as the speed of sound. They don't have to be. They don't have to be better than that.
I agree. So we tried to make an effort to make all of the primaries equal length. Technically, the primary length is too long to where it can't scavenge the way it should to really make the most power. But when we were building the car, there were basically three things that were important to us. One, it looked the part. Two, it sounded the part. And it performed.
So, I couldn't even imagine what an 8-into-1 sounds like on that motor. I've never seen that configuration until I saw those pictures.
To give you an example, when we fired it the first time, when I was talking about on that Sunday, and it actually fired, the butterfly idle set screws were opened a bit too much. So it started to creep on RPM, right? Yep. So when it started to creep on RPM, Brett just shut the power down. And I'm like, okay, we thought it got to red line. That's what it sounded like, right? Mm-hmm. And we looked at the data, and the data said 2,400 RPM. So it fools you.
Yeah.
At 6,000 RPM, when that thing's, you know, going down the track, it sounds like it's spinning 10.
Which, yeah, it probably, with the header design like that, sounds like a big flat plane crank.
And the thing is, when you do an exhaust system like that, it washes away the effect of the crank sound. Yes. Because you are literally timing each exhaust pulse, all eight, every two revs, equal space from one another.
Well, you're effectively running two four-cylinder motors in tandem at that point, rather than having an eight-cylinder trading off banks.
It doesn't know. It's like it's the easiest way to separate each exhaust by doing 8-into-1.
I need to try it.
And for all of you guys, the guy that built this, Richard Waitis, who is the king shit at Magnaflow, he is an awesome guy. We've had him on here before. Thad and Zach shot a video with him a little while ago for Engineered on the Tune Network on Drive. Go check it out, because he gets into some crazy, crazy exhaust design stuff, and he is an interesting, interesting guy to listen to. So, Jonathan, you were at the track, and you...
No, I wasn't. I got super sick from the LA Auto Show, and I could not go. I knew you were supposed to be going. I was so pissed. I got so sick from like talking,
i.e. IPAs and that, Jack Daniels.
That too. No, I went to the LA Auto Show, which was last week.
See, that's your first mistake, is going to the LA Auto Show.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. There's whole
I did
backstories.
After
that,
SEMA, I didn't have another show in me.
I'll tell you off air. But it was just I got so sick after that, and I had to do a tour Saturday morning for the LA Auto Show for the general public.
So you were a docent too?
I was. Right before that, I had completely lost my voice. I had nothing. Like, I have a little bit of it now, but
were you like me nothing. Thursday SEMA gone or
yep.
Okay.
Completely gone. Yeah. So I'm thankfully, I was the only tour to get a microphone for all 20 people, so they could actually hear me. But throughout the entire show, I was popping lozenges and drinking tea. So it probably didn't sound great on the microphone, me going or like messing around with lozenges. But I got through it. But after that, I literally got home. I had like 101 fever, and I just... passed out. My wife was like, "Are you okay?" Like poking me, seeing if I was dead. I was just like, "No, I am dying." But I was so heartbroken that I couldn't make it.
There was a guy that messaged me on Instagram saying, "Hey, I'd love to take some pictures." And he's like, "Do you have a photographer coming?" I'm like, "Yeah, there's somebody coming out, but you're more than welcome to come take pictures." So then you had sent me a message saying you couldn't make it, you were sick. So I was like, "Hey, yeah, you're more than welcome to come out, whatever." So he came out, he took pictures, which I can share with you. You can
cool. Do
whatever you like with them.
I think we may have to make a field trip down and see things.
For sure.
Yeah.
I got to get the car out of the trailer. So,
well,
it's still parked in there from the weekend, but let me know.
That's okay.
Well, it's Thanksgiving week, so everybody's kind of relaxing this week. So let us know when things are convenient. And there's a few people, I think we'll make a day of it. There's a few people we got to go see after SEMA down there. We got to go see the WiseTech guys. They invited us to come by too.
I've got a car coming that might be fun, but okay. I don't know how much of a mileage limit I have on it yet.
Okay.
Bentley Continental GTC.
Oh, they won't have a big mileage limit on
like
that. Bentley's not usually.
Which sucks. Whatever.
Well, we're going to Orange County. You have to take the Bentley to Orange County.
For sure. I won't let you arrive in anything else.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. Not my dirty ass golf right now. There's that. Which I do have to say. Okay, so I finally got the Pierce Motorsports chassis bracing and sway bar.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Is
it a front sway bar or a rear sway bar?
Front sway. Yeah. Sway. Okay, my tires are completely bald right now. They are shit. They are shot to shit. It increases the turn in so drastically.
Yeah.
It feels like an M3 or McLaren.
And your car, Golf R is not a car that's known for major chassis deficiencies either.
No, it is very good. Like, stock, I was able to walk around 5.0 Mustangs on track and M4s and shit like that. This takes it to a whole nother level.
Well, you've driven
psychotic.
A Fiesta, and you drove my Fiesta after the bracing.
Yeah.
And that thing is...
It's GT3.
This is a lot more. Crazy. Like, if I put good tires on it, good sticky tires, I will walk everyone through the canyon.
It is amazing.
It is stupid quick.
The work that he is doing over there. And you've got to meet Jim at some point. Jim, you get along with...
I think I did, yeah.
Did you?
Because
Jim was an off-road racer for years and years. He ran Baja. He ran with Craig Stanton and all those guys for a long time. You guys would have some good conversations.
Didn't he design the chassis for the CTSV that you guys are building?
Wait a second. Is he in Torrance?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay.
But, okay. But
do we need to edit something there?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
No,
we're good.
No, but... The chassis bracing on my car right now, if I had really good sticky tires,
yeah,
there's no one can catch me. It corners flatter than I have. It's stupid quick. Like I took an on ramp or an off ramp in it, and usually I could do about 8 miles an hour. I did 11. And at 8 miles an hour before the chassis bracing, it was starting to get a little bit rolly. After the chassis bracing, it still felt like it had a lot more to go. And it just felt like the tires were about to give up. And I was just like, I'd rather not go into a wall at 11 miles an hour. That's probably not a great idea. So I backed out. But some of the on-ramps around here are just... It's flat, terrifyingly quick.
It was
the turn in is honestly just stupid quick.
Yeah, the for is relatively inexpensive as those parts are. They're the first thing I tell people to buy now. I'm like, just go get the chat. If they've got it for those cars, go buy it.
What does it do exactly?
So on like the Fiestas, for example, economy car platform to begin with. So the suspension pickup points in the front, there's just a lot of slop and a lot of lateral movement that happens on them because they're not super high quality pieces. So doing a lot of things like actually doing some bridging between both sides of the suspension and things like that, and then tying it back further into the chassis.
Gotcha.
So
mine goes about halfway back, the chassis bracing.
So McPherson's truck car has a lower control arm.
Yep.
So it basically ties those lower control arm points together underneath the bottom of the car.
Yeah.
And then
it's got kind of a trapezoid that goes back and then bolts back behind the front wheels. So, yeah, it just ties everything together and,
gotcha.
And gets rid of all that slop, especially if you get on a cheap Max Strut car.
Yeah. And that's where the load is. That
lower control arm, I mean, so. On a front-wheel drive car, I made the joke before, but I'm like, well, it's only responsible for acceleration, braking, and turning.
Yeah.
You know?
You need to lop the back of the car off. Put fast food trays under it. You're good.
What do you think that is right there?
Yeah, I've done that a number of times.
That is Bob Bondurant's first lunch tray drift.
Holy shit.
One yeah.
So you know what trays work pretty fantastic?
Cookie sheets.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Better. Yeah. The In-N-Out Burger fast food trays are very deep, right?
Okay.
Yeah. And they're relatively small. They kind of cup the bottom of the tire really good.
Ah. So. See, my go-to now is like cookie sheets if I'm going to do that, although I really don't.
That throws sparks too.
Yeah. That's why you do it at night.
Yeah.
Where do you do this? And why haven't I been invited?
I haven't done that in many years, but I haven't owned – this is the first front-wheel drive car I've owned in a long time.
I was thinking I don't own a front-wheel drive car, so.
Yeah. I bought the Fiesta as my daily.
You can do it with your car.
He's got a 500 electric, which is amusing in and of itself.
There you go.
It's hilarious. Windows down as fast as you can. I can't comprehend it. I hear birds and tire squealing, nothing else.
Birds and tire squealing.
Well, that's like a Tesla, though. I mean, it's just like you get in them and you put your foot down to the floor and you're like...
It was so disconcerting when I first
saw it. It's bizarre to go that fast with no noise.
This is another... this brings me to something else. I feel like our generation, we grew up with cars that are throaty and V8s and whatnot. And the sad thing is I think we're approaching the end of that generation, maybe.
Well, if Formula One keeps going with the stupid turbo sixes, yeah.
God, but even still, I mean, did you guys see there was a Formula E race at Long Beach this year?
Yeah. Okay.
And yeah, the cars could be as fast as whatever, but there's something like passion-wise that you feel in here when you hear a strung-out whatever.
Yeah.
That and you smell it. I think it's just something for all the senses.
Here's the thing that I'm okay with the Formula E, is because there is no noise. They can race them anywhere now. And they've done it, like they did it, they did an event in downtown LA. You could never run an indie event or a drift event or anything down there because everybody would bitch about the noise. They ran those things down there, no problem, because the only inconvenience was the fact that some of the streets were blocked off. Hmm. Nobody was bitching about noise because it's just.
I will say this. Okay, so we touched upon it in the Hotchkiss podcast, which will be coming out soonish.
Yeah.
I went from the V8s to the sixes in Formula One. So first year I went was the V8s and religious experience. I went to COTA.
Gotcha. Me too. I was there.
Yeah.
Just that was the Hamilton. Well.
Yeah.
Has Hamilton won every year since COTA's been open? I
mean, no. Vettel.
Who won? Oh, Vettel last year.
Vettel. Yeah. Vettel was the last.
And the rain won this year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I went to the V8s and then to the V's or the inline sixes and. I had a half-hour conversation trackside during the V6s. I didn't need to raise my voice at all. There was something missing about it. It's like the V8s, you sat on the tunnels or you sat on the bridges, and they would go right under you, and you would feel it in your chest, and you could hear it 2 miles away, and it was brilliant, and it was raw. Then you go in the 6s, and you're like, well, this fucking sucks.
Yeah. But how much of that is mandated design, though, on their part? Because
it's the FIA because
they're trying to get their fuel.
Yeah,
fuel is a big deal.
But not even the fuel. But I mean, you can have all kinds of crazy engine characteristics.
No. But okay, so the way that these turbo sixes work is they're limited by fuel flow.
Right.
So they're actually designed to go to 15,000-16,000 RPM, mm-hmm. and they'll sound brilliant. But because of the fuel flow issue and because of the fuel issue in general in Formula One, they aren't allowed to go to the 15,000.
But that's what I'm getting to.
They are allowed to go, but it's not practical for them to go to that. They run them at 11,000 or 12,000 RPM or whatever it is because it doesn't exceed the fuel flow and they can still make power there.
Right.
Right. So, but what I'm getting to is it's not an inherent problem with the number of cylinders on the motor. It could be a 10-cylinder. It could be a 3-cylinder and be fantastic sounding.
Well, you even have the 4-cylinders in GRC that sound amazing.
Yeah.
The sound is still different, though. The more cylinders you have, the higher the frequency is going to be.
Yeah. Well, and then you've got – and then, of course, you had, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, you had the Turbo 4 Formula One cars, too, and those sounded great. But they also weren't encumbered by the same limitations in design that they have now.
And my personal favorite power.
Yeah. They did. They were 1,200 1,500 horsepower cars. I mean, we had Gail Banks in here, and I had said, isn't it funny how we're getting like 300 horsepower out of 1.6s on road going cars? And he goes, I was building cars in 1975 that were 1.4 liters and were making 2,000 horsepower. And I'm like, of course you were. You're Gail Banks.
Yeah. Well, you had Ford in the 80s doing the RS200s for Group B. Those cars were making 800 horsepower in a 1.8 liter, you know, turbocharged 4-cylinder. And they were doing it with 1.8060s. It was faster than McLaren's at the time on gravel.
Well, engine is an air pump. You can do, I mean, the number of cylinders is largely inconsequential. I mean, until you get down to a single cylinder when things get really weird.
I'd still rather have a V10.
but
sound from the power, water right now.
But the power can be whatever you need it to be. It's what other characteristics do you want to have the motor to have.
Displacement. Yeah. What's the displacement? How much air are you pumping? Yeah.
Yeah. And displacement can be emulated with a turbocharger. It's just that easy. I mean, that's effectively what we do. I laugh how, like, everybody's, like, playing along in this game that, like, oh, yeah, the turbo engines are more fuel efficient. And I just go, no, they're not. You're still moving the same amount of air. And a lot of times I found, like, in the turbocharged Fords, like the 3.5 EcoBoost, actually I've seen that put out worse fuel economy than the Coyote V8 does. Because
mine is terrible.
Yeah.
But that's also because it's a VW.
Well, it's also VW. You know. Well, I mean, I was looking at the average mile per gallon on my Fiesta on the way over here. It's 22 in a 1.6.
That's still better than what I get.
It's still. I mean, it's like they sell these things. 18. Like, you know, they sell it, you know, on the window sticker. I think it says like 37 average or something like that. And I'm like, I'm
never.
Almost never. I get – maybe almost half of that. You know, it's just a little more than half of that. So,
I wasn't super stellar in thermodynamics in school, but I think there is some efficiency gains with a turbocharger using exhaust pressure. And
oh yeah, I mean you take all that lost energy and you're recapturing that, and then you've got some people like BMW even going to the point where they're taking the heat that gets wasted off of the turbocharger. Running a water jacket around that, and then basically running that steam to run another compressor that generates electricity and then dumps that into a battery.
Jeez.
So they're taking the uncaptured waste heat from the turbocharger and recycling that, which is...
It's like a power plant. It's going to have cooling towers off the top next.
Yeah, so probably.
Like a set of stacks.
Yeah.
Probably. Well, we're in an hour 20 now. You know, which is very long for Hooniverse. TST, we do this crap all the time, but Hooniverse, we usually...
Last episode was, what, hour 40?
It was 2 hours.
Jesus
2 hours. We used to go... Back when people used to enjoy lots of beverages when we did it at the house that the boys shared, we had a few that exceeded 3 hours.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Those are early days. Four years in, we're not doing that so often. But anyway, besides all of that... Where the hell can we find your beautiful cars and suspension designs?
On Instagram, mostly. Okay. I pretty much post everything that's the newest thing we've been working on Instagram.
And what is the Instagram tag?
The Instagram tag is Scarbo Performance.
Scarbo Performance. Yes. It's spelled exactly as it sounds.
S-C-A-R-B-O.
Yep. Scarbo.
Yep.
And then if somebody's interested in a rolling chassis of one of your Ferraris, where should they go?
Our website is www.scarboperformance.com. And they can fill out a contact form. We have all the build sheets.
Huh? I'm seeing a theme with the website names and such.
Seems easier.
It's easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. but yeah, they can go on there. They can contact us through the website. And we have build sheets on there that basically say what all those six different models.
Right. I know you're building suspension parts for BBI. Mm-hmm. Is there anybody else that you're building stuff for that they can buy right off the shelf?
Parts to buy. BBI, we do BBI's slave cylinder for them. As well, that's not really a suspension part, but it's a trick little part. It's a fourth axis CNC part. Beautiful when it comes off the machine. Unfortunately, it gets hard black anodized. But
although you painted the Ferrari,
I did. So, long story short,
it's so beautiful. Yeah. The bare aluminum. See, and I saw it. I was like, it's still beautiful.
But the funny thing here's the thing.
So gorgeous in the aluminum.
We appreciate it. Because we're metal fabricators and welders,
mm-hmm.
but we could never afford it, really.
No.
The guy that can afford it's the guy that appreciates the painted body.
I don't know anybody in this business that's building crazy shit that can afford the cars that they're building.
Well, you have the Ring brothers that can't afford any of their stuff.
No. No.
And they're just like...
You talk to Bodie. Bodie doesn't have his cars. You talk to Foose. I think Foose might have one of his cars.
No,
you
know, he's got a couple.
And he's been doing it for 30-some-odd years. You know, and there's just not that many people that own the stuff that they build. I mean, it's not like Batim's rolling around in one of his $300,000 race cars every day.
And at the end of the day, we all do it because we're passionate about it, you know. We go to work every day because it's fun. It makes us smile. And I guess maybe that's the compromise.
But... Oh, I would rather have that. Like, I mean, so today I got to drive a Super Performance Shelby Daytona coupe. And it's been one of my bucket list type of cars, because I've loved that car forever. I'm not making any money at that point, but I'm going to drive. And I posted it up on Facebook. I was just like, yeah, my old cubicle can suck it at this point.
Seriously.
I get to do this every day.
You know, I literally make zero money doing TST and Hooniverse. I do it because I get to come in, bullshit with my friends, have interesting conversations with folks like you, and try to get Harrison to speak. That's what I do.
Can I make one quick plug?
Absolutely.
I was in Montana, met some really awesome people doing some 3D printing. I want to do a shout out to their company, Niche Motoring, because they did some awesome 3D printing switches.
And as in a small interest niche?
Very small interest. But
I mean in terms of the spelling.
Well, a lot of neat 1M coupes and crazy RX-7.
The 1M.
I thought were going to kill me. So.
The favorite car that I've driven in the last few years is the Dynan 1M. So you will never hear me say a disparaging thing about a 1 Series.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, Jonathan, what have you written lately and where can we find you?
Well, I finally put out my gear. Part one of my gear stuff that I got from Alpine Stars and Shoei after my accident. It's the RF1200 helmet and the Alpine Stars GP Tech jacket, which is pretty much just a half section of a MotoGP full suit. It's wonderful. You should check out that. I have my Prius review, which you'll get a kick out of because I never thought I'd ever actually write these words, but fun Prius do end up in the text.
Did you autocross it?
We autocrossed a Prius and a RAV4 hybrid. And that's the only way you should test.
I remember when you told me you were doing it, and I asked why, and you said this is why we're doing it. But
So the RAV4 hybrid, real quickly, we're going to go longer. The RAV4 hybrid, the chief engineer used to be a chassis engineer. He used to And he has Drift Supra that he races all the time. Really, really fun guy to talk to. And he's just like, I really wanted to pay more attention to the suspension on it. I wanted it to handle better. And he's just like, I know most of the people are not going to give two shits about, handling on the RAV4. Mm-hmm. But we put it through a fucking autocross circuit fast. I mean, we were going very fast in it, and we were actually timing ourselves at the end of it, but it's a really good suspension setup. It's a really good chassis setup, and even the Prius lost its rear – I can't remember what it was. I talk about it in the article, which will be coming out very soon, but it went into independent rear suspension, and we actually got to drive the last generation Prius versus the new generation Prius. The last generation Prius is hysterically terrible. Just a god-awful piece of shit. The new generation Prius is actually stupid amounts of fun and will handle. Well, much to the chagrin of our lovely actual host, Jeff Glucker.
I think they've had to step up their game a little bit with the competition coming in from other places. Like the Volt is not a shabby hybrid.
It's not bad. Like, honestly, okay, so the review that was right before it was the Honda NM4, the motorcycle that I was riding around. And in the end of that review, I actually said I'd rather have the Prius. Because I drove the NM4 to the Prius launch. It's that good that I'd rather have
Fair
that
enough. And so we can find that at boldride.com.
You can. And then me at Jonathan_Klein on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay. And every podcast ever.
And every podcast ever.
Hey, I have that designation.
You hope you have that designation at this point.
I don't. There are people that are actually do more than I do, surprisingly. Harrison, where can we find you on the social medias?
Harrison Burdan at pretty much Instagram, Twitter, basics.
All right. And as usual, find me at Haze Data on Twitter. That's where I do most of my yelling at people.
I was going to add that. I was like, hey,
yelling there. I do more yelling in real life, surprisingly. You don't work with me. That's the thing. You don't work with me on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I do more yelling in real life. And then, of course, if you guys have some inclination to a podcast, come over to my company, Shout Engine. We'll set you up. We'll get you going free. We're going to be making some big, big, big changes in January that I cannot announce yet, and I keep teasing because I keep moving back a little bit. But suffice to say, things are going to get much less expensive and I think a lot more interesting. So please rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Also go and, you know, Hooniverse.com. Go look at Hooniverse Jeff on Twitter because he is their normal host that is not here because he's doing things. And like I said, rate and review us on iTunes. That helps greatly. Thanks again for coming out. I really appreciate it. I got to go take a look at your cars in Orange County sometime after we all gorge on turkey.
Anytime.
And that's another episode of the Hooniverse Podcast.
Cool.